Well, good morning and good afternoon, depending on where you are, and good evening, I suppose, if people are coming in from overseas. What I'm going to talk about today is gaining real-time intelligence from talking to people. There's nothing more real-time than talking to people, even though people on social media, which I adore, think that's real-time. It's pretty real-time, but you miss out on hearing the tone of the other person at the other end of the line, for example. They might be lying. They might be misrepresenting themselves. You know, there's just nothing. It's hard to be fooled by a voice when you do this all day long. So I'm going to go into the next slide here, if this will work. I can't get this thing to advance. Is there any trick to that now? There we go. So the next best thing to knowing your own business is to know about the other fellow's business, and really that's a lot of what this interviewing process is about. I'm going to focus on how you can find the right person to talk to, and not focus on that, sorry, but more on how to prepare yourself to talk to a person and be present and effective while you're doing it. And the last half of the talk will be teaching you some elicitation skills on kind of how to get people to talk, and I'll give you examples as I go along. So the first thing is you need to have a cooperative attitude. I'm the empress of cooperative intelligence, and you know, really that is it's the attitude of being a giver and not a taker. It comes right through on the phone that you are a taker if that's what you're doing, and it's all about me, me, me. It's all about them. Just put your ego aside, get to the other end of the phone as fast as you can. And so you're sitting with them, having a conversation, chatting tableside. That's your goal as someone who's interviewing someone over the phone. And the phone is what I'm going to concentrate on here as well, because that's the way most of us have to do this, right? It's a lot easier actually when you're in person, but we don't have time to go into all the body language today. So, but even if you're doing the asking, you know, figure out a way to get back to this person, even if it's just to make them feel good about sharing repeatedly throughout the interview and at the end. And that's why elicitation tools are so effective that I'll be going into a little later on. And really, I love this saying by Dr. Maya Angelou, because at the end of the day, people a lot of times forget all about what was said in the interview, but they remember how you made them feel at the end when you hang up the phone. So you need to keep that in mind when you're talking to people, anytime really, but on the phone as well. So who are you? Trick or treat, right? But what is your persona as you're talking on the phone? What role? What is your role as an interviewer? Why would they want to talk to you? Do you want them to find out who hired you, or is this a blind study? This really matters. Get all this really organized. In a recent project, I spoke to about 40 people, and it was blind, although enough people probably figured out who I was calling on behalf of. But my plea to get them to talk is that I needed their expertise to help the manufacturer develop better products for them to use in the future. And a confident tone, no matter who it is you are, your persona, carries the day. If you're not confident, boy, does it come through, and people just don't really want to talk to you. And that's true in person as well. But over the phone, you know, you just have that voice, right, and that silence or, you know, fewer cues. It's more obvious. So, and then when you're thinking of the other person, is this a cold call? Do you know this person? What have they shared before? If you do, what's their attitude about sharing information? Are they more apt to hold their cards closer to their chest, their comfort zone? Is there a certain trigger that you know of that will get them to share more? And also, what will you share when they ask questions? You need to have all this in your mind before you pick up the phone. So, this is probably overkill, but it really isn't. You need to think about the other person as though you see them in person, and you're on the other, even though you're on the phone. And think about what their profession is. You know that even on a cold call, chances are you know what their profession is. So you know their predisposition based on the fact of what they do. They're an accountant. They're a financial manager. They're what they are, right? Politics. Well, just be aware of it, right? Personal issues like charitable causes, associations. Sometimes these are nice conversational breakers. But don't dig too deep on relationships if you don't know somebody very well. It makes them very uncomfortable. Their predisposition, kind of like where they are at in the Myers-Briggs test, which I'm not going to go into, but a little bit more on the DISC, which measures four dimensions of behavioral response, because that's what I'm thinking about when I'm talking to somebody, is how are they going to respond to me, and how do I need to be to maximize their comfort in responding to me. So a dominant person, as this person looks like, is quite confident, direct, and appreciates you being direct as well. They're often risk takers and more apt to cause ulcers than to have them, right? But the best way to communicate them is get right to the point. Don't tell a lot of stories. Provide brief, crisp, direct answers, and ask what questions. So that's the dominant. The next type, wait a minute, did I skip one here? Yeah, is the influencer. And this is somebody who is quite jovial as he looks there, but he really, really cares about, you need to bowl them over, I guess is the right word, and convince them, because they are an influencer, you need to be strong enough to come across to them as well. Okay, then steady and amicable. They sound like they're fun people to talk to, and they are. They're often good listeners, but sometimes they're harder to get them to talk because they're touchy-feely types. So they kind of need to know what you're discussing, and will help maybe improve performance and without raising conflict. They're friendly, amicable people. And conscientious folks, they tend to be very analytical. And if you happen to know that about somebody, they're like micromanagers, might have a lot of questions for you that maybe you want to be prepared for. So it's really important to kind of keep in mind that people, maybe they're not one of these four types, but to be prepared for any of those four types, or, you know, a lot of times people are a combination of them. And the other thing to keep in mind is how they will react under stress. Does that change their predisposition? And because sometimes we are delivering, or our interviews can become stressful. So here's the key to interviewing. You need to do your research first. You need to research the industry, the profession, learn some of their jargon enough that they realize you at least know what you're talking about, but you're not the expert that they're going to be, and you want to let them know that as well. But they need to know you know enough that they'll want to engage with you, especially technology, engineering, manufacturing, you know, really every industry has its language, and you need to learn it. So I always take a crash course at the outset of every project. And another great source is YouTube. I love YouTube for learning an industry. I just did one on portable handheld meters, which I'll be talking about throughout for examples. And it was the most wonderful YouTube, which just showed me how these meters are, how they operate. The guy even took it apart, showed you the back of it. It was just amazing what's out there. And then if you want to warm up your call, you can go to LinkedIn or Google the company website, industry associations. I try not to go and spend too much time at this, but I spend some time so the person knows I haven't just picked up the phone, I've thought about it. And be organized. What are you going to hit them with as soon as they answer the phone? Will this vary? Why? Maybe their tone tells you they might be more friendly or not. First impressions are so important. And again, that confidence. Have that confidence inside of yourself that they are going to cooperate with you. At the same time, yourself, don't be cocky. Be more unassuming and humble, but confident. Then prepare yourself. A lot of people think this is silly, maybe, but I think one of the most important things you can do before you pick up the phone is to get grounded. And how I do it, everybody has a different way to do it, is I simply just take some really deep breaths and get very grounded. And even before I dial the phone, you know, each time I might do it, even if I'm dialing the phone, just get myself totally grounded, it makes a huge difference because you're so present with the moment. Those distractions that you might be thinking about, they go away. And that's really important. And the person at the other end of the line, they can tell. You have their attention. That is probably one of the biggest findings of my last year of doing this, which is incredible. My success rate with interviewing has just skyrocketed ever since I've decided I'm going to get grounded before I pick up the phone. It means I can do it, when I'm having a bad day versus thinking, oh, I can't do this today. I'm just too tired. Some excuse or the other. I can always get grounded. Okay, so thinking about the questions, formulating relevant questions to this project, and also your relationship with the person. What is your relationship with the person? A lot of times, you know, it's a cold call when we're doing competitive intelligence projects, right? But let's assume you know a little something about them. Think about someone like good journalists when they give interviews, like Terry Gross of NPR. They prepare their talk shows, they read the books, they do their homework. And then I always say, reword your questions to motivate sharing. Have them be in such a way that it makes it easy for them to want to answer the question, especially since you've done your research. If you actually get to the time and ability to do so, about what this person's like, because the information is almost always out there. So as you're reverting your questions, think about their ego. Minimize the threat to their ego. So you'll start with broad, open-ended questions. And I'll just kind of give an example with this meter company I was just working for, an electronic meter that you hold in your hand to measure electricity, right? And that's kind of what the project was. And so we kind of started out very broadly with, well, what do you do for a living? And, you know, kind of how has this changed over the last few years? And these guys were the technicians or engineers or calibrators of this equipment, various types of people, but all, you know, using this equipment. Some of them casual homeowners, some of them used it 20 times a day. But this got everybody talking because nobody really cares most of the time. So they're interested in engaging when you ask them how it is for them, basically. Then a hypothetical question, an example of that would be, we'd ask them about the equipment they used, and we'd want to know if they bought again, which brand would they buy? Because we really wanted to know about brand loyalty. And they might say something like, well, you know, I don't know what I'm going to buy again, or something equally vague. So I would say, well, if you bought again, what would it be? And I would get to it that way. The indirect questions I'll get to when I get to the elicitation portion of this talk. And then narrowing questions in the same example, we would get to, do you install, troubleshoot, repair, or maintain equipment? And they were happy to tell you about this, once again, because nobody cares about what they do for a living, but this is more narrow. And then, narrower yet, what electrical parameters do you measure at work? Current, voltage, ohms, AC, DC, all this kind of stuff, as far as their maximum voltage and amperage requirements. So, give you an idea, and you kind of work your way from the broad to the narrow. And as an interviewer, you need to be sensitive to when it's the right time to move on by listening to them, by being with them, and just putting yourself on hold. So you're listening to the cues. You need to be patient. You need to be alert. And also flexible to realize, oh, this person really doesn't know the answers to a lot of the questions that we have. And actually, what this person knows is so much more valuable to this project. And I'll give you an example. And you need to think about this on a dime while you're talking to them in that 15 or 20 minutes and make that judgment early on in the call. So, for example, during this project, I had the pleasure of interviewing a calibration professional. And what they do is they get these meters and they basically repair them and they get them back to the settings that they came from the manufacturer. And that's what he did for a living for these particular types of meters. And he worked with everybody's meter, all the brands and models and everything. And when I realized this, I realized, oh, I'm not going to ask him all these other questions. I'm going to just ask him what he thinks happening in the marketplace, what's changing, how it's changed in the last 10 years. And I could tell he really didn't care to tell me about the particulars about the meters he owned. He knew so much more. He was dying to tell someone about it. This was extremely valuable to my customer. And so, if I wasn't listening quite closely, I might have missed out on that and just interviewed him like everybody else. And the intelligence he shared was just incredible. Some of the things that people do, it's very easy to do when you're on a phone call. You need to lay aside your preconceived notions of how you think that person's going to be in terms of how it is you listen to what they're saying. It's only human nature to have some preconceived notions. This guy's a technician, therefore he or she is like this, probably he, right? But the point is, if you let your preconceived notions get in the way, you're not going to really be listening to what this person is saying, and that is the objective of what you're doing, right? So you just want to be so attuned to the other person, again, as I said earlier, that you feel like you're sitting with them in person instead of talking to them over the telephone. So the next batch of this talk is going to be on elicitation. Since a lot of people kind of think it's interesting, and it is a very effective way to get people to share information with you. And it's an art and a science. And a lot of people will mix elicitation and interviewing back and forth, you know, and that works. Ultimately, you need to figure out what works for you and what you're comfortable with. So, you know, take the comments I'm sharing with you and think about what works for you, because everybody has a different comfort zone, ethics aside, you know, just what your style is, what you're comfortable with. But the idea behind elicitation is it's conversational and it's very methodical. You prepare for the interview quite extensively before you pick up the phone, or you do them in person. You know, you can use them any which way. And with customers, competitors, industry experts, works with anybody. But the point behind it is it avoids direct questions, encourages openness, and conversation reduces concern and suspicion. So it induces the other person to talk with comfort, but it also takes time. But it works. So if you're using this in business, though, not just a one-time phone call, you really need to think about, consider the win-win of this process and not exploit your customer, for example. Salespeople can use this or other sources of information because, you know, people can later on wonder about things, right? And you don't want that. So why elicitation? When you ask people questions, direct questions, a lot of times they remember them better than a conversation. It's just human nature. And these are the kinds of things they wonder at the end of the interview if they told you things that maybe they weren't so comfortable with. You know, who is this person that called me? Why are they asking this? And what's it in for me to share this, you know? And how much should I share? I hope I didn't share too much. I wonder where this is going. That's the sort of thing that sometimes comes about out of interviews at the end. So elicitor skills, just moving along here. In general, people who are good at elicitation have a natural gift for making friends because it is conversational. They're good listeners, full listeners, not egoful. Establish rapport well and do it quickly. Also have this psychological insight about the person they're talking to because they do their homework before they pick up the phone or talk to you. And they have broad general knowledge, and the reason why that's good is as the conversation moves along, conversations never quite go the way you have planned for them to go. And if you have broad general knowledge, a lot of times you can fill in the gaps and move back to where you had hoped for that conversation to go, or you can realize, well, let's take this other avenue. I might learn even more that I hadn't thought about before. A good memory, because especially if you're talking to somebody in person, not over the telephone when you're taking notes, like at a conference where you're gathering intelligence. And a two-level listener, by that I mean is, what are they not saying that I really thought they would? Or what are they not saying that I think they know and they don't want to say? Okay? So A good elicitor also is highly intuitive, spontaneous, appreciates cultural and national differences while conducting these. And so that's kind of a skill set. And really, I think it's a very similar skill set to a good journalist, a good interviewer, frankly. So let's get into what elicitation is and the planning of the conversation. You need to keep in mind your personality, how you come across. The person you're talking to, I say target, maybe that's kind of a cold word, but their personality, what are they like? where are you trying to go with this conversation, and how are you going to get there? Okay? And you actually want to take a look at all of this, building on what you already know, and also taking advantage of human tendencies. The thing about elicitation is it is cross-cultural. A lot of the elicitation techniques are human nature, and it doesn't matter where in the world you are, they are human nature. Now, the way people express themselves is what's different, okay? So human characteristics in elicitation and why it works. These are the things that are just cross-cultural. People want to be recognized, appreciated. People are curious. Everybody responds to being recognized and having their ego stroked, right? Recognized as a expert in their industry. And people like to gossip and complain, you know. And people are not good at keeping secrets, so they'll tell you often enough while they're showing off something or the other. And I refer to these as occupational hazards, advising, teaching, correcting, challenging. People love to correct me all the time. Doesn't matter what occupation it is. These technicians I was talking to, they were all set to correct me, which was great. I was there to learn. So, and then people also will do the aw shucks and downplay accomplishments. That's pretty common as well. They love to correct you, again, or prove that you're wrong. The other thing is, if you can get people kind of on the emotional end of things, they a lot of times will say more than they realize they're saying. And with elicitation, they'll forget about it too. So there really is an art and a science to this. So I'm going to show you kind of what elicitation looks like. And you'll notice at the bottom of the page, paraphrase from Confidential, a book by John Nolan on page 28. It's a fabulous book. I thought at first it was just on counterintelligence, and I realized when I bought the book, oh, actually, there's a whole bunch on elicitation in here, which he's really well known for, but I hadn't realized it was in the book because I thought with a title like Confidential, it was more counterintelligence. So I'm going to go through this, and I'm going to give you an example at the same time, okay? And I'm going to do it in this meter, electric testing and measurement meter example. In the beginning, I'd look up everybody, but not so much concern about the individual, but just the company they work for, because I had their titles, their names and titles, and what company and what phone number from a database. But I knew nothing else about them. But based on where they worked, I had a pretty good idea of what they might have done, and that was actually enough. But I did go and look at the internet for each of the companies before I called them, just to have an idea of what they do. Are they big? Are they small? And have an appreciation, especially those in manufacturing. Probably half the calls were to industrial settings. And so I wanted to have an idea of what they manufactured before I called them. So I had an idea of how they were using these handheld meters and what sort of dangers they would have in their setting. So, all right. So then in the meter example, I'll just start out. I started out with the open-ended questions about where they worked and what it was like for them, as I had mentioned earlier. And I'd let them know that I'd looked them up on their business on the web, but without exactly saying that. They just would sort of know that. And often they would correct me, which was great, because that really got them talking early on. And they also liked this in general, because nobody usually asks. Then we got to what I cared about, because now they were talking, okay? What I was really interested in is how are they using this equipment and what brands and models do they use and why and specific decision-making criteria. And that was all totally just conversational, you know. And a lot of times all I'd have to do is just say, and how do you use these meters? And they would tell me how they use them and answer many of the questions that I had. I could actually ask that like that because it had come out of the conversation before. And then I could use some of these elicitation skills that I'll be going into. And I ended it up, though, because you want to end with something pretty innocuous, so they kind of forget about the middle stuff. So the last question I asked them was their age, you know, and I bracketed it. I didn't ask their exact age. But I'd often comment that they didn't sound like their age because so many people really look young, sound young on the phone. And what was interesting about that is I kind of just did that one or two times kind of because it surprised me, you know, spontaneously. And I came to find out a lot of these people would then add some more nuggets of things that I was done, you know. It was just very interesting how that works. The other thing I would do at the end, which is not part of the elicitation, and that's why I say you need to decide how you're going to use these tools, but I always ask them if there's something else they'd like to tell me that I didn't ask, that they think, you know, they'll just get it off their chest about these meters or whoever their manufacturer is or whatever, or if they had any questions for me. And a lot of times that just makes the person feel good. And so I always say, take these skills and use them in a way that works for you. Okay, now we're going to move on to the actual elicitation techniques. The first one here is just an expression of mutual interest. And, you know, it's like having a hobby or something in common, right? And in the example of the meters, I kind of just said, boy, you know, when you work with electricity, I bet safety's got to be a key concern. And often enough, oh, right away, you know, they start talking, oh, yes, in fact, we ended up, and one of them was really interesting, because in fact, we ended up buying this brand because one person's meter blew up in our factory, proceeded to tell us all kinds of good things about this new brand, and it just turned out that new brand was the brand I was targeting, so I was very happy about that. Wasn't happy about hearing about an explosion yet, but, you know, we're talking electricity, so. Provocative statement. This is always kind of fun. You know, it's playful. And that's the thing about elicitation, too. It is playful. And for me, it's like second nature. And I'm kind of a playful person, so it's not something that was too tough to... I was doing it, actually, without even knowing it existed, to be honest. So in this meter one, this one was hilarious. I call up, and this guy answers the phone, and he's sitting in a crane, operating a crane while he answers the phone. Oh, my God. And so I said to him, how quickly, you know, thinking to myself, how quickly I get this guy off the phone? I want to talk to him. So right away, I was just told him what I was doing and said I couldn't believe he answered his phone while operating a crane. And could we talk when he was, you know, like on the ground? And anyway, it was provocative in that the guy gave me a time to call him back. And we had a very nice conversation. And he remembered me because I guess other people maybe didn't have the same reaction to him answering while operating a crane. Simple flattery. This is probably the easiest one and the one that most people are comfortable with. And flattery works. But flattery works only if you mean it. If you're just coming on with it and you don't mean it, they can tell. So don't go there, right? In the metering project, this was really easy since I don't use electronic meters, you know. I mean, your appliance repair person that comes to the house or someone who's looking at your dishwasher or your washer, dryer, electrician, HVAC, refrigeration, they all use these things, right? But I did read up on them. So I would just basically mention to them, you know, I'm just calling you since you use these meters and there's no better source than you on what's good, bad, and dangerous or safe about these meters. And that's really what we're looking for. And often enough, they would tell me they've been an electrician for 30 years or 40 years. And I would ooh and ah and ask them what they noticed had changed in their industry and learn a lot that way as well. Trends was a key question my client had, and I never had to ask it directly. And that was kind of nice because it's, I don't know, I think that question often can be uncomfortable for people. Naive mentality. Well, you know, you don't want to be too stupid, but you know, if you don't quite know what's going on, people just want to correct you. They want to instruct you. It doesn't matter what walk of life, unless you're catching them at a bad time. They tend to want to do that. So one of the guys told me he was using a competitor's meter from the guys who had hired me to do this project. And I told him I only knew how to operate the market leader's meters, and I knew about their model numbers, so would he mind telling me how they compare and why he chose the competitor. And he went on for a good 15 minutes and kind of told me all about it. And that was really useful because the client, the weakness of this project, had only given me their database of their customers. And I thought it would have been nice to have some competitors' customers mixed in. And I had gone and found this guy on my own. He's kind of a friend of a friend. And that was really good. taking an opposing stand. Sometimes that makes the other person at the other end of the line uncomfortable, so you need to keep that in mind with this one, I think. But with one guy in the metering project, I just couldn't get any valuable information from him. He used the market leader's product, but for a different reason than anyone I had talked to so far. And he said, oh, they all have similar performance, except that the market leader's products were more expensive. So I thought, well, why are you using them? And so I asked him that, you know. And he said, well, ergonomically, there's no comparison. This fits into my hand like a glove. And I even went as far as to say, well maybe this market leader should just reduce their price and make their molds like everybody else's. That's kind of what got him going, and then finally he gave me the information I needed, but I kind of had to be a little provocative to get it out of him. Unbelieving attitude. Denial of the obvious leads to enlightenment. Well, you know, it's kind of fun. Another easy one was when people would tell me their age, and I mentioned earlier at the end of the interview for each of the metering projects, they often sounded younger than their age. And the conversation went on another 5 minutes because I made a remark like that or something similar, you know. Quid pro quo. This always works. It's human nature. I'll share if you share. And in the metering project, they didn't really care who else I was calling, but some wanted to learn what I was learning, basically, about the equipment usage of others, other electricians, or others in the industrial space. And I remember I was talking to this one guy in Hawaii, and I called him. We talked about 10 minutes. He said, I got a meeting. He said, but if you call me at 6:30 a.m. Hawaiian time, which is 10:30 my time, tomorrow morning or the next morning, I'm happy to talk to you. And we were on the phone a good half hour, and that's the reason we were. I really told him what I was up to, not who the competition was or anything or who had hired me, but just what I was up to because he was interested. And he really shared a lot of good information about how they use the meters at their shop, various types of meters. And the other thing I think is, in my case with this project, the quid pro quo. They weren't sure that I knew what I was doing or talking about at first because I'm a woman and this is a man's world. So I had to deal with that too, but they also were kind of amused by it. So, you know, take advantage of your situation, I guess, you know, and know what it is though. Purposely erroneous statements. A lot of people ethically have a problem with this because if you know you're lying, you shouldn't be doing this. I disagree. And the reason why is I like to test the validity of my sources. So sometimes, especially when I know this person is supposed to be really good and a key source, and I'm hanging my hat on this interview, I really want to make sure they're as good as people tell me they are or I think they are. So I'll say something that's a little off. And if they don't correct me, then I wonder, are they really that expert? So it's kind of something to keep in mind. But in today's information age, it's almost impossible not to find something that can be misquoted or misunderstood or mistaken. And often enough, I make a statement that's erroneous and it's not purposeful. I just didn't know any better. So those are some ideas around the erroneous statements. Oblique references. These are kind of indirect comments, either positive, negative. But your idea is you're just trying to get them to engage again, right? It's another human nature thing. And I'll give you an example, not actually from this project, but just, you know, everyday life. I don't believe I use this much in this project. Another example, just kind of saying to the person, oh, the other day I was talking to my dad and he said that your company has been losing share in the food business. And people have this desire often enough when you say that, and it's your somebody you know or they know you know very well. They want to correct you. And so they said back, well, actually, you know, we've lost share in the beverage industry, not the food business, and go on from there. So this is not one of my favorites, but, you know, once again, what's comfortable to you is what you got to figure out. This is one I love. Exploit the instinct to complain. Doesn't matter what space you're in, what culture you're in, people complain. Complain, complain. Now, Asian people might be less likely to share that with you, but everybody has it. So in the case of this metering project, the market leader, their prices were quite a bit higher than anybody else's. So I very often would get them talking about pricing as a decision-making criteria, and just, you know, the complaining mode, and really to find out if that was making them not want to buy the next version of this competitor's product, or if it was worth it to them, you know, that sort of thing. I was really trying to get at that. But since people often do complain about the money, I thought that would be a good angle to get at. Okay, we're getting pretty close to the end because I want to leave enough time for questions. Bracketing techniques. That's another good one, where you start broader and get narrower. And I have kind of gone into a little bit of this during the interviewing portion before I started the solicitation. But, for example, if it's something that they're not comfortable with, you know they're not comfortable with, like revenues, you can bracket it. You know, is it between 10 and 20 million? Because if it's a privately held company, you probably don't know the amount at all, right? Or age is another one. Like with this project, I thought, well, a lot of people might not be comfortable with the age thing, and I'll ask them that at the end after we're all warmed up and everything, because most everybody told me their exact age. I didn't ask for it. I just said, oh, you know, we're just kind of want to go through and do the demographics at the end and just know who we're talking to, because we keep our interviews confidential. But it's good for them to realize kind of the age bracket of who we're talking to. And so anything that's quantitative that you think they're going to be uncomfortable with, bracketing techniques is really a useful thing, and it's more acceptable. But bracketing techniques is something, once again, that you don't start your interview with. That's as you move along, you do it. You get into it when you realize they're a little more comfortable talking with you. And silence. Silence is so golden. It is just a wonderful thing. If you have a chatty person and they're talking about that which you're interested in and they're staying on topic, just let them go. Take notes, right? Right fast. The challenge with it is they're on a roll and then they go off target and you think, oh, I want to get back on again, but I don't want them to lose their positive energy and their steam. So you have to decide if you're going to let them go off track for a few minutes and then bring them back gently. That's a real skill, is that jockeying back and forth to realize, okay, I've been quiet long enough now. We need to move along with this conversation. It's not going the way that I had planned. And the guys, for example, my metering project that I talked to from Texas were so friendly. And another guy from New Mexico, in fact, in the kitchen, commercial kitchen area, chatty as he could be. I could still be on the phone with him at the end. Well, thank you so much for calling. I must have had 10 or 15 Texans and New Mexico kind of types. Thank you so much. And I'm thinking, thank you. I'm the one who's getting the information. But it's really interesting how people can be. But a lot of it is, and the reason why they do this is they're nice people, but also because you've given them the chance to express themselves in a way that makes them feel valued. And that just doesn't happen much in life these days, especially on the job. And a lot of people aren't on the phone all that much except like with their families and stuff like that. So, you know, I want to just leave you with that idea of just keep in mind when you're interviewing people and you're talking to people, it's just so important to keep in mind their ego, where they're coming from, and make them feel good about the process, that you're not extracting information at their expense, that you're conversing with them and treating them like a really decent human being. So this concludes my comments here. I think it's about 11:45. I think we were supposed to talk for about 45 minutes, if I understood correctly. And I'm happy to take questions. And I ended this up with ready, set, go. You know, really, you know, hopefully this is going to help you pick up the phone, or actually get ready before you pick up the phone and get confident with your ability to do this if you're not already. and go do it. Thank
Ellen,
you.
that was fantastic. And just as a reminder for those who are listening, if you do have questions, you can go ahead and type those in the questions window, and we will pass those along. And for those who have asked, as a reminder, these slides will be available. If you've registered for the webinar, which you obviously have if you're listening, you'll receive an email afterwards with a link to all the slides from today. As far as questions, Ellen, one of those has come through is, a lot of these techniques have benefits and drawbacks. How do you avoid introducing bias in your interview process?
Benefits and drawbacks, and how do I
avoid bias? How do you avoid bias?
On my part or their part?
I believe what the question is getting at is more of how do you avoid leading the interviewee as far as there is a preconceived notion. It's more along the market research, classical market research question. Pathway, which is you certainly don't want it to be proving a point that you already think is the case. You'd rather let the evidence dictate what the truth is as opposed to potentially leading your interviewer on. Certainly, as I was looking at your presentation, I think that specifically spoke to some of the more confrontational or not necessarily confrontational, but those techniques in which you're deliberately provoking a response.
Okay. Let me explain what elicitation is. You're trying to get people to talk, but your objective is not to bias them. Your objective is get them to share, and that's the objective behind all those elicitation skills. As far as bias goes, everybody that you talk to has bias, and so do you. And the only way to remove that is to talk to enough people, I think, in a survey or, as you're interviewing people, so that that removes some of the bias, or at least it neutralizes some of the bias, right? Like, for example, in this metering project, I was trying to get at, my bottom line was, there's a certain type of meter that we think is becoming more popular in the marketplace, but we're not sure, versus another type that's been there for a long time. That was the thesis behind the whole project. I didn't ask but two or three people that question because the movement this way is very inadvertent. And so you as an interviewer need to have the skill to know if that person actually, in the case of me anyway, realizes what they're doing. Because a lot of movement that happens in the marketplace actually is inadvertent. It's not quite so planned or, what I'm saying? It sort of happens because people change their habits. Okay. Does that answer the question? I'm not sure.
I think it does. Another question which is showing up. Which of these is, in your opinion, the hardest to develop?
The hardest to develop in terms of what?
I'm speculating here, but I believe what it refers to is the hardest to learn.
Elicitation skills, you mean?
Yeah.
I don't think any of them are that hard to learn. I think the issue is you need to practice them. But the other is you need to figure out what you're comfortable with. Some people, flattery, they like to use that one. They like to use the one where people like to complain, You need to decide comfortable for you and what feels right for the situation. Elicitation is like any other discipline, any other practice you're going to do in life. You need to do it again and again and again. I've been doing this since 1985. I don't even think about it. In fact, to write a talk like this, I have to really sit and think about, now what do I do? What are the steps I take? Because they become just part of who you are.
Totally understand that, Ellen. It seems like a follow-up question would be: you've obviously had a lot of experience. How would somebody without that experience develop that? I mean, certainly, like the provocative ones. It can't necessarily just provoke your friends left and right.
No, you might not have any leftover. Yeah, you might not. Well, actually, you can, though, because you do it in a playful way. You don't do it to get them angry with you, but you do it in a playful way. You can do it around sports, all kinds of things. Think about it. But you know what we often do when we do these training sessions is we have people go try some of these techniques out, and there's 56 of them. I just did 12. I think they're very similar to each other. That's why I just pick out 12. But the hotel staff, wait staff, people that you're never going to see again are the people to practice on at first. Then I had a friend who told me, oh, I practice on my wife all the time. She's standing right there as he's saying that. I said, oh, great. Good marriage. Yeah. Yeah, so, but I think practicing them in an area where, or with people that you're not going to see again is a good idea. But just practicing them, you know, and also don't take yourself so seriously. I think a lot of times with these different elicitation skills or when we're learning something new, our tendency is to take ourselves a little bit too seriously. And, you know, you can have a good time with this. Be playful with it. It's really not that tough. But the other thing to know is not everybody is set up to be a skilled interviewer. That's something to know, too. Not everybody is set up naturally, has a predisposition to be a good interviewer. Not everybody is good at extracting loads of information off millions of sources like an octopus on the internet. Know what your skills are. Know what it is you want to go after based on what your own personal predisposition is. So I also want to share that because not everybody's cut out for this. A lot of the larger CI firms, a lot of churn in those firms for people that do primary research because not everybody's happy doing this. And they also burn out from doing it because you do it day in and day out. I happen to be one of those people who loves to do this. So I love to talk to people. I love to hear their stories. So I'm really lucky that way. But not everybody has that predisposition.
Yep, and certainly your passion shows in the way that you're giving this presentation as well as just the experiences that you've had. At this point, there aren't any other questions, so I think we can give a few minutes back to those who are listening, a few extra minutes between webinars. So, again, Ellen, thank you very much, and for those who are listening,
yes.
The audio as well as the presentations will be available after this webinar.
Okay, so you'll turn me off now?
Whenever you're ready, you can go ahead.
All I got to do is hang up my phone. Yeah, you know,
exactly.
I could hear you all just fine. I just couldn't find the right hole. I don't know. Anyway.
Thanks for your patience, Ellen.
Thank you. Well, thank you all for your patience. I hate that when people I'm trying to listen to can't even hear them.
Excellent. Well, we'll start the next webinar at 2 o'clock Eastern, which would be 11 o'clock Pacific or noon Mountain Time.